When the National Arts Club presents P.D. James with its Medal of Honor for Literature tomorrow, it will be the first time that a writer of crime fiction has been so honored. At the age of 85, Baroness James has just published her 19th book, The Lighthouse, the 13th featuring Commander Adam Dalgliesh of Scotland Yard. And it is a great pleasure to welcome her back to my show today.
It's lovely to be back, Leonard.
Among the previous recipients of the award are Saul Bellow, Arthur Miller, Toni Morrison. Is it gratifying to have your work placed in that kind of company?
Oh, immensely. I've only got to read the names of the previous recipients of the honour to realise how very greatly I'm being honoured on Tuesday. Yes. Tomorrow.
On the other hand, you have always aspired to transcend the mystery genre, and you've often cited Jane Austen as one of your favourite writers. So it's perhaps less of a surprise than if it were somebody who wrote pulp mysteries.
Yes, I've tried as a writer to provide, you know, a credible and exciting mystery, but also to explore, you know, men and women under the trauma of a police investigation for murder and to say something true about the society in which they live. So I'm really trying to be a good novelist who works within the conventions and structure of well-known, well-worn form.
You said what gives any mystery writer the claim to be regarded as a serious novelist is the power to create a sense of place, to make it as real to the reader as his own living room, and then to people it with characters who are suffering men and women, not stereotypes to be knocked down like dummies in the final chapter. So why write in a genre at all? Was it because that was the easiest way to get published when you began?
Not altogether. I think I realized that if I could do it well, there would be a good chance of getting it published. It's such a popular form. And I very much enjoyed reading mysteries when I was an adolescent. It was my favorite form of recreational reading. But I've got a feeling, Leonard, you know, that we don't so much choose our genre, that the genre chooses us. I think I'm intrigued by structure. I like working within the constraints of structure. I like seeing what I can do with a form that could be regarded as somewhat outworn.
Although a few years ago you wrote The Children of Men, which has been described as science fiction or speculative fiction, did you enjoy that departure from your usual form?
Well, it was rather a traumatic book to write, but I'm very glad I did write it, and I can see the influence of detective fiction, but of course, in a sense, it's getting very close to science fiction. In the end, it became somewhat of a Christian fable, although that is not what I set out to do. But there are two books which are not detective stories, that and Innocent Blood. And I suppose, you know, if I received an idea that was really excited me, Leonard, but wasn't suitable for the detective form, I would still write another so-called straight novel. But I'm very happy with the detective story. I feel I can do what I need to do within it.
Well, you said that in the case of Children of Men, it turned out to not be what you'd set out to write. So is that one of the pleasures of writing within a genre, that it tends to turn out the way you had originally intended?
Yes,
are you surprised even there?
That is interesting because of the way I write and the necessity for the clues and for everything to be accurate, I do a great deal of plotting and planning and research before I begin writing. Numerous notebooks full of notes and charts and so on. But nevertheless, I never get quite the novel I thought I was going to get. And I think that's largely because when I write about the characters, they seem to reveal themselves to me more closely. And although I never really lose control of them because I can't, they do sort of show lives of their own, and I have new ideas for clues. The book changes in very mysterious ways, and that's one of the excitements, of course, of writing a novel.
In The Lighthouse, the murder doesn't occur until a quarter of the way through the book. can you imagine leaving out murder altogether? I remember that Dorothy L. Sayers did that in one of her Lord Peter Wimsey novels, Gaudy Night, and a lot of people got upset.
I love that book. Not everyone does, but I like it. And of course, you're absolutely right. It's a very good mystery, but there's no murder. No, I think I do need to have the actual murder. And I think if I were writing a novel that wasn't a mystery, I can't imagine it without a death somehow in it. I think I must be rather intrigued by death.
Although you don't actually describe the murder. You usually describe what we see when we come upon the body.
Exactly. It's absolutely right. People say, well, how do you write these sort of rather terrifying descriptions of murder? But they're not terrifying descriptions of murder. They are frightening and perhaps terrifying descriptions of the finding of the body, because I think that's such an important part of the book. And I always describe it through the eyes and the mind of the person who makes the discovery. And of course, it's horrific for them, and it has to be horrific for the reader, too.
Is that based on personal experience? I'm sure you haven't come upon a body, but you did work in a forensic lab. In fact, setting is always important to your books. You've had hospitals, forensic labs, publishing companies, all places that
I've only seen two dead bodies actually in my life, which is surprising being in London throughout the war when we were being bombed a great deal. But I didn't see any of the victims. I wasn't actually in the forensic lab, but I was responsible for administering them. And you're so right, because this did give me very, very useful experience. All my working and bureaucratic life has been very useful to me in providing knowledge and experience, which I wouldn't otherwise have had.
But I'd also imagine that when you were at the lab, the question often, it would have occurred to me, what led to this situation? And I tend to make up stories when I see something interesting that I have no answers to.
Yes, I do too. And I think I did from childhood, when make up stories when I see something interesting. The laboratory, the forensic science laboratory, which is in Lambeth in London, the staff there are unfailingly helpful to me. And I couldn't have written some of the books without, you know, that help and without their knowledge. And particularly in the one before this, the murder room, where for the first time I had the victim killed by fire, by being burnt alive in his car. And of course, I needed to spend some time in the fire investigation department with them, finding out exactly how a fire is investigated, because accuracy is tremendously important to me.
Well, the lighthouse takes place far from London. It's set on Combe Island, a fictional island off the coast of Cornwall. Is this based on a place you visited?
No, this is a strange, and for me, a rather unusual beginning to a book, because my novels nearly always begin with a place. And it's a place usually that I know and that I have visited, and it's had a huge effect on me. And I hadn't ever visited an island really like Combe Island, but I had the idea that I wanted to set it on an island, and an island with a particular history and a particular purpose. So the island is totally imaginary.
A Retreat for the Wealthy and Famous. My guest is P.D. James, whose latest novel, her latest Adam Dalgliesh mystery, is The Lighthouse, and it is published by Knopp. You said you wanted a place that had a history, and you give the place a long history. It was first used by pirates and slavers, then owned by the Holcombe family, or Holcombe, I guess it is, and eventually turned over to a charitable trust. Is it important to create a whole backstory for your setting, even if it's not immediately relevant to the current events?
Yes, it is, Leonard, and tremendously important also with the characters, that I need to know, you know, what their family were like, what their parents were like, where they were educated. None of that may appear in the book, but I really need to know it. And I want the place to have a history, which, as you so rightly said, this place indeed has.
Like many of your settings, Combe is a family enterprise that's possibly in danger of extinction. In previous books, you've depicted a family-owned publishing company and a private museum that might have been lost. Do you feel that too many of these institutions are being lost?
Well, yes, put it like that. It has been a repetition of at least one of the motives. Because they're very, very different institutions, really, the publishing house and the museum and now the island, which is an island retreat. But I suppose it's a fairly common motive, trying to preserve something that is tremendously important to one, at least, of the characters, and which is threatened by an outsider.
Well, the murder within a closed society is a convention of mystery fiction often used by Agatha Christie and others. And also, in this case, we have a victim who almost everybody wanted to kill, something that Agatha Christie also liked. You haven't been much of an admirer of Agatha Christie. Did it occur to you that getting a little close?
Well, indeed it did, you see. I wanted very much to set it on the island, and I wanted it to be this kind of island, but you're so right. I mean, I was aware that this is a very common setting for a detective novelist because it's so convenient. You've got all your characters sort of isolated. And I wanted it to be as different as possible from any other detective story set on an island. I don't, I suppose, admire Agatha Christie as a novelist, as a writer, but of course I do admire the extraordinary ingenuity that she showed. And, you know, she's given pleasure, relaxation for millions of people in peace and war, and that's a considerable achievement, really, isn't it?
Well, the big difference is her characters are generally stereotypes.
They are, indeed.
And one of your strengths has always been in delineating characters. Yes. Who come to life as individuals. I guess you are more interested in the why than in the who or how. In this case, you have these temporary guests, a laboratory director under siege from animal rights activists, a retired German diplomat, a famous writer, along with his daughter and editor. Was that just an accident, what they were, or did you have some reason for making them that, not something else?
Because the Island Trust has been set up to provide a refuge for people who are very eminent so that they can get away from their protection officers, get away from their mobile phones, because get away from the stress of very busy lives of great responsibility. So they had to be people in rather important jobs. And the director of a laboratory using primates for research, that seemed rather natural. And also the retired diplomat, of course. And the author, not only is a very great author, I'm hoping that does come over, however unpleasant, he is a very great novelist. But he has a right to be there anyway because he was born on the island and under the trust they can't keep him out. And they very much hope they could keep him out because he's an extremely difficult human being.
We're talking about Nathan Oliver, who treats everyone, including his own daughter, as if they were his personal servants.
Absolutely.
You've been on the Booker Prize committee and met a lot of writers. Is Oliver an amalgam of the worst you've known?
No, he's honestly not based on any writer I've known at all. But I had no difficulty in imagining him. I can pick out sort of emotions which I think writers might have and magnify them. I think it was Graham Greene who said writers have a splinter of ice in the heart. And I do acknowledge the splinter of ice in the heart, the detachment which enables one sometimes to look at one's own unhappiness and misery and somehow stand aside of it and describe it. And this is a man really with a great chunk of ice in his heart. And one can see why. I mean, I had no sympathy with him in one way, but I understood. Here's a man who had one great talent, and the whole of his life has been spent in developing it. There's been nothing else of any satisfaction at all. And now he has an awful feeling that he may be getting Alzheimer's, that anyway, the words are no longer there.
Even the resort staff is made up of troubled people, an alcoholic former priest, a doctor who fled London after misdiagnosing a case and that causes a child's death, a recently widowed lawyer. And into all of this comes Commander Adam Dalgleish, who investigates, winds up being sidelined by illness. Did you know he was going to be ill somewhere down the line when you started the book?
Yes, I did. I did know that. I did know that. I wanted to make it credible that the island would continue to be cut off. A very valid reason. But once, you see, when he first comes on the island, he's expected to let the authorities in London know, because they have good purpose for wanting to know, whether this is accident, suicide, or murder. But once it was murder, in real life, probably the local police would have taken over. I didn't want them to take over. I wanted it still to be Dalgleish's case and his team's case. So I had this idea that they would be cut off by a quarantine.
He's reached a point in his career where he's called on only to deal with the most sensitive cases.
Yes.
Can you imagine him retiring entirely from actual detective work? I mean, you've been writing about him for 43 years.
And
although he hasn't aged 43 years, he has gotten on in years.
Well, we have to. I think he's changed a bit, and I think he's become much more sensitive to the ambiguities, the moral ambiguities of his job, the fact that he loves to preserve his own privacy but has a job that actually not only enables him but necessitates him destroying the privacy of other people. So he's changed and become rather more sensitive in some ways.
He doesn't have that sliver of ice in his heart the way
he would have retired 20 years ago. We have to suspend our disbelief, really. But of course, the fact that I've been writing these, he may have had several of these cases in 1 year, we have to remember. But all the same, I wish I were as ageless as my hero is.
Well, I get the feeling that you're setting up Kate Miskin, his second in command, to take over the bulk of these cases.
Well, it's a nice idea that he might retire and Kate take over. I've certainly given Kate, of course, in this book, a much more prominent part to play. And I like writing about Kate very much. And she's a very important character to me. And I suppose that if I had begun writing now, I probably would have had a woman as my chief detective. But, of course, when I began all those years ago, there were no women in the detective force, not at a senior level, so it wouldn't have been realistic. So I'm just glad that she is there, the second in command, and this time she was left on her own and with a subordinate, you know, whom she's not very happy with, to solve the case.
Along with your fellow writer Ruth Rendell, who was here a couple of months back, you've taken your life period seriously, regularly attend sessions of the House of Lords. Is there now a mystery writer's block in Parliament?
No, there are only the two of us, as far as we know. And Ruth is a greater, more regular. She's much more used to her party than I am to mine. She was appointed as what's called a working peer, so she has to go there, whether she wants to or not, whereas I was a non-working peer, so I don't have to do that. And I'm afraid that I don't show my face as often as I should. But she is very meticulous and a great use, I think, to her side.
But you've said that if you were forced to choose between writing and public service, you choose the public service.
I'm sure I would have said I would have chosen writing, but I have enjoyed public service, and I was on numerous committees, of course, when I was younger, and I did very much enjoy that. I think it brought me into touch with people I wouldn't otherwise have met and with lives that I wouldn't otherwise have met.
Of course, you also worked as a hospital administrator,
yes,
at the Home Office as a magistrate, so you've done public service.
Yes.
After each of the last several books, you've declined to say if there'll ever be another Dalgliesh book, but I got the sense from this conversation that there probably will be.
Oh, Leonard, I'd love to write another, and I certainly hope to write another.
A Murder in the House of Lords, what do you think?
Well, that's a great idea, really, but I think the difficulty is that you're not even allowed to die in the House of Lords. If you die in the House of Lords, you're shoved into an ambulance pretty quickly, and officially you die on the way to the hospital. I'm not sure whether Dalgliesh would be able to investigate. The main problem, which is quite a serious one, is that if you sit in the House of Lords, people know who the Prime Minister is, they know who the Lord Chancellor is, they know who the leader of the opposition is, so that it becomes all rather unreal. And I do like to try and write a credible mystery.
You've dedicated this novel to your late husband, although he died over 40 years ago.
Yes.
You talked about the pain that even successful writers have to deal with in their personal lives. Was that in your mind when you were writing this book?
I suppose to an extent it's always the back of my mind. I don't think it was more so with this book. But although I dedicated a previous one both to my husband and our two daughters, I hadn't previously dedicated one to him on his own. And when I'd finished this, I thought, well, it could be the last one. I hope it won't be, but it could be. And I wanted him to have a book that was dedicated just to him.
P.D. James will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. The latest book is The Lighthouse, an Adam Dalgliesh mystery, and it is published by Knopf. And I want to thank you so much for being with us, and congratulations on the Medal of Honor for Literature that you will be receiving from the National Arts Club tomorrow.
You're very kindly going to come and emcee the proceedings, which is very kind of you, Leonard, and I'm looking forward to seeing you then.